We investigated a series of actions by the president towards the investigation. Based on Justice Department policy and principles of fairness, we decided we would not make a determination as to whether the president committed a crime. That was our decision then, and it remains our decision today.
That began the day when Mueller testified before the House Judiciary Committee. He later moved on to speak before the House Intelligence Committee. As expected, he wasn't the most talkative witness.
I can't answer that question.
That's not within my purview.
I direct you to what we have written in the report in terms of whatever was said will appear in the report. I'm not going to get into that.
Not going to get into details.
But that did not stop Republicans or Democrats from trying to win political points. Democrats spent their time trying to get Mueller to confirm the most damning parts of his investigation, most notably the 10 instances where President Trump may have obstructed justice. Here's New York's Hakeem Jeffries.
Is it fair to say that Donald Trump viewed the special counsel's investigation into his conduct as adverse to his own interests?
I think that generally is true.
The investigation found evidence, quote, that the president knew that he should not have directed Don McGahn to fire the special counsel, correct?
And where do you have that quote?
Page 90, volume 2. There is evidence that the president knew he should not have made those calls to McGahn, close quote.
I see that, yes, that's accurate.
The investigation also found substantial evidence that President Trump repeatedly urged McGahn to dispute that he was ordered to have the special counsel terminated, correct?
Correct.
And Republicans spent their time underlying the fact that Mueller did not recommend prosecuting Trump and by trying to discredit the investigation by implying Mueller was basically in the tank for Democrats. Here's Kelly Armstrong from North Dakota.
If a team of lawyers worked for, donated thousands of dollars to, and went to Trump's parties instead of Clinton's, I don't think we'd be here trying to prop up an obstruction allegation. My colleagues would have spent the last 4 months accusing your team of being bought and paid for by the Trump campaign, and we couldn't trust a single word of this report.
Let's get into some analysis now with Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal. Hi.
Hi.
Also joining us, Alex Wayne, White House editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Alex.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Ilya Shapiro, director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. Welcome to you.
Good to be on.
Jessica, let's begin with you. What did we learn from these hours of testimony?
I think we learned you should be careful what you ask for, in the sense that Democrats really pushed hard for these hearings. And let's be clear, this wasn't truly a fact-finding mission. If you really wanted to get Robert Mueller to answer more questions, this isn't the way you would set that up. This is political theater. This is about trying to educate the American public about something that 99.9% of them haven't read, which is the Mueller report. And so when you want to do that, I think you have to be really careful about who you cast as your lead character. And someone said last night, no sane person would ever cast Robert Mueller in the role of Robert Mueller. And I think what we saw today is that's largely true. He was exactly what we thought. He was very reticent to be there. He gave one-word answers, and he often said, I refer you to the report. And that doesn't make for good political theater. That doesn't give you that viral moment. It's not a win in terms of trying to show the American public, this is why we should go down the road to impeachment proceedings.
Right. And so I guess they were trying to look for him to give them some kind of food for that, some kind of reason to go forward. I just want to play a clip from his exchange again with Ted Lieu. And this is a Santa Monica Democrat.
I'd like to ask you, the reason again that you did not indict Donald Trump is because of OLC opinion stating that you cannot indict a sitting president, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so he said, no, that is the cannot indict a sitting president. We've heard this many times under this OLC rule, this guidance. And then he went back and kind of corrected himself at the beginning of the second hearing. And then he said this before Ken Buck, a Republican from Colorado, his questions.
Could you charge the president with a crime after he left office?
Yes.
You believe that he committed, you could charge the president of the United States with obstruction of justice after he left office?
Yes.
Okay, so Ilya Shapiro, what's going on there?
Well, this is the debate about whether you could charge a sitting president? What does Mueller's decision not to make a call on obstruction mean? There was a key moment, actually, from the start of the second hearing in the afternoon after lunch, where he clarified the response to Congressman Liu, who had said, basically had asked whether the reason he didn't indict the president was because of the OLC opinion, the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department, that says you can't indict a sitting president. And in the morning, Mueller said yes. In the afternoon, he clarified, I didn't mean to say or to imply or to give the impression that the only reason we didn't indict was because of this OLC opinion. We took no position on whether the president committed an indictable offense. And this was just clarifying further, well, what about when he's no longer the sitting president? And here Mueller says clearly yes, although there was some further discussion in this afternoon's hearing before the Intelligence Committee. Well, what happens if it's a two-term presidency and the statute of limitations runs? Does that mean the statute of limitations is told until the president gets out, or what does that mean? And there Mueller said, well, I don't know. I haven't considered it. That would take further legal analysis. But this is all getting to the point of what did Mueller really mean when he said, you know, did he imply that there was no obstruction, he couldn't find obstruction, or simply that they didn't pursue it one way or another because they knew they couldn't indict him in the first place.
Right. And so did he provide the smoking gun, if you will, Jessica, to this question? I mean, this is the key question for the Democrats.
This was like a water gun that won't fire at a backyard party. So no, there was not a smoking gun moment. And in fact, I mean, the morning kind of felt like that junior high play where everybody's really trying hard and sometimes you just try and increase your volume, but you're not actually landing any punches or any audience opening scenes. So I would say that no, I don't actually think either side scored a lot of political points. And I think that you've zeroed in on exactly the exchange where it looked like, oh my goodness, there is news here. There is actually a moment where he's saying, but for the Office of Legal Counsel memo, we would mm-hmm. have gone on to indict the president. And then immediately, you know, you take it right back. The air is just pulled out from the scene. And he says, I just want to clarify, I wasn't saying anything that wasn't in the report. And we go back to where we started.
Okay. So Alex Wayne at the White House, the president is tweeting today. He seems to be pretty happy with the way things are panning out.
Yeah, the White House won't say whether he watched the hearing, but it's notable that the Marine Guard, who's usually posted outside of the West Wing when the president is there, was not in his position as of 11 a.m. this morning. That doesn't necessarily mean the president definitely wasn't in the White House, but he probably was in the residence watching the hearing, let's be honest.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so he was tweeting about it. And so in general, what have White House aides been saying or anyone around surrounding the president? Are they saying that this is pretty good for him, that it doesn't look like there's going to be any negative political fallout or too much negative political fallout?
His spokesperson, his new press secretary, Stephanie Grisham, said that Democrats have embarrassed themselves with this hearing. The president himself obviously seems very pleased with what's happened on Capitol Hill today. And, you know, I'll add that that not only did Democrats get the smoking gun that they were after, Mueller himself presented as a, I don't know what the fair word is, so I'm going to use a word that maybe isn't fair, but he presented as an infirm witness. He repeatedly asked lawmakers to repeat their questions. He repeatedly asked them to cite passages in his report, even passages that are quite familiar by now because they've been reported on so much. It was almost as if he had, I'm afraid, a not entirely solid recollection of his own work.
Mm. Wow. Okay. So, Jessica, would you agree with that? That he wasn't, I mean, you said earlier he wasn't the best of witnesses, not the witness that you'd want to play himself if you were casting Mueller. But do you think he did damage just, I guess, you know, I hate this word, but just through the optics?
Yes. So I think you can't escape that. And in part because what we were supposed to get from Robert Mueller, at the very least, was a command of the facts. And it looked like he didn't quite have that at his fingertips. Having said that, what we saw in terms of the questioners are, let's think of who they are and how they got their jobs. This is a group of people who got their jobs as a result of winning popularity contests that are largely conducted through speeches, television ads, debates. And so this is more their skill set. Robert Mueller did not audition for the role of special counsel, and he's not a made-for-TV witness. Having said that, there were a couple of cringeworthy moments where he forgot the president who had appointed him to a role, where he said he thought it was Bush, it was actually Reagan. A number of times where he said, "I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Could you repeat yourself?" I do think it's worth mentioning, we don't really allow people to be real people on TV when it comes to these hearings, but Robert Mueller didn't help. I think the Democrats who were hoping that he was going to, you know, charge in with a cape and say, "Let me tell you," wink, nod, explicitly, "God, I wish I could have indicted him for obstruction of justice."
Okay, so the Democrats had to do that instead. And so let's listen to Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee.
Donald Trump was trying to make millions from a real estate deal in Moscow.
To the extent you're talking about the hotel in Moscow?
Yes.
Yes.
When your investigation looked into these matters, numerous Trump associates lied to your team, the grand jury, and to Congress?
Number of persons that we interviewed in our investigation, it turns out, did lie.
Mike Flynn lied?
He was convicted of lying, yes.
George Papadopoulos was convicted of lying?
True.
Paul Manafort was convicted of lying?
True.
Paul Manafort was, in fact, went so far as to encourage other people to lie?
That is accurate.
Okay, so Ilya, going back to you, in terms of laying out exactly what this investigation has determined, is that meat with which the Democrats can move forward, whether or not they decide to proceed with an impeachment inquiry?
Only if they were prepared before the hearing to move forward. We learned nothing. There was absolutely no news generated by this hearing. As Mueller said going into the hearing, that he would just be testifying about the four corners of his report. And as you just alluded, effectively, this was no more than the report itself testifying. It wasn't very colorful. I think that's on purpose. You know, Mueller's testified 80-something times before Congress. You know, maybe he's lost a step, or maybe he's just tired with this whole imbroglio. But you know, I think both Democrats and Republicans got video clips that they'll be incorporating into their re-election campaign ads. But no, there was no smoking gun, no new news, no push towards or away from impeachment or any other position anyone might have. Basically, whatever anyone, whether a Congress member or the lay public watching this, whatever view you had coming into today, I think you remain unchanged.
Well, in fact, the current Attorney General Bob Barr, he is actually going to look into whether or not how this investigation began in the first place, apparently. So, Alex, where does this go from here when it comes to carrying on a separate investigation into how Mueller was investigating? And I'm sorry, yeah, I said Bob Barr, I meant Bill Barr.
I think that investigation actually could be pretty interesting and might reveal things that the president perhaps would prefer not be revealed. If Barr conducts it honestly and without bias, and that's of course an open question. But we don't know much about where this investigation came from. Republicans have repeatedly said it was from this dossier full of scandalous information about the president that was circulated before the election. But I believe the FBI, the Intelligence Committee, has said that that's not entirely true. That they had other leads prior to that dossier were being created.
Yeah. And so, Jessica, this leads us to, again, a he said, he said, she said, she said, stew of what's the truth, I guess, if you're just a regular viewer to this. A lot of names were dropped that some of us had never heard before, people that some of the Republicans raised, for example, who Mueller did not investigate, and why didn't he investigate this name and this name? And it just becomes a lot of verbiage. Where does that leave the average person listening to or watching these hearings?
Yeah, I guess I would say two things. First, with respect to the investigation into the investigation, we should actually ask ourselves, why does that matter? And I mean that seriously, in the sense of, let's say you had a dirty cop, but he uncovered an actual crime. And the prosecutor, because every prosecutor, including every person, has some sort of political bias, had a political bias. if the system still works, if the prosecutor brings that case and there is a defense attorney and there is a judge and the jury decides to convict or not to convict, that verdict isn't somehow undercut because the people who started that investigation were biased. So I think we really need to separate that. It doesn't mean Paul Manafort all of a sudden is independent. It doesn't mean that President Trump didn't invite interference from Russia. It doesn't mean that President Trump didn't try and tell Don McGahn, I think you should fire Robert Mueller. It doesn't undercut the facts and the guilty pleas and the convictions that we've seen. The second thing, and I think it's so important that you ask, where does this leave the American public? This is the thing that's most troubling to me, which is we have Robert Mueller giving a 448-page report, and we still have the American public in a place where I think they're largely in the dark, they're confused, they're getting their information filtered from somewhat biased sources, and it doesn't provide them with a place of what happened and where to go. And I think this is an indictment of America in the sense that what your view this morning of the Mueller report is probably the same as your view this afternoon. So I don't have a good answer to where you go. My guess is if Democrats are smart, they're going to, politically speaking, I think that they're not going to believe that you can get people out to vote in 2020 based on the Mueller report. They're going to turn to how can I make your life better, voter, as opposed to remember those Mueller hearings. I think that you're really going to vote for me because of that.
Okay. And Alex Wayne, what about politically from the White House? I believe President Trump is engaging in some kind of campaign rally tonight. Is he going to be still saying witch hunt, winch hunt, and keep saying that, or will he want to move on?
I think we expect him to pat himself on the back this afternoon when he departs for that fundraiser in West Virginia. He won't be making public remarks at that fundraiser, supposedly. But I don't think he's going to drop it. That's sort of what helps keep this alive with voters, is that the president keeps talking about this investigation and its outcomes. And for voters who are interested in learning more about what the president is talking about, because he keeps mentioning it, there's a vast amount of coverage, honest coverage by Real News, explaining what the special counsel found.
Right. And what do you think, Ilya? Is this a campaign event or a campaign topic going forward for either side, or would it be best if both sides just dropped it and moved on?
Again, the same way that it was before. Trump is going to say, they couldn't prove anything. There was no collusion or conspiracy or whatever the lawyers want to call it. They didn't have it. They didn't find it because I didn't do it. And the Democrats are going to say, well, he couldn't rule it out. He detailed all of these people in Trump's orbit that were engaged with the Russians and doing this and that. This doesn't move the ball one way or another.
All right. Ilya Shapiro, director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute, Alex Wayne, White House editor for Bloomberg News, and Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor. Thank you both. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Republicans on the committees today defended President Trump, hardly a shred of criticism from them. That is because the party has become his, and that shift in the GOP started well before Donald Trump ran for president.
Here come all of these Tea Partiers with pitchforks, and they are forming this insurgency that winds up swallowing up the Republican establishment whole, and in many ways laying the groundwork for the ascendancy of Donald Trump a few years later.
Coming up, Tim Alberta on his new book, American Carnage. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It is often said that Donald Trump has mounted a hostile takeover of the Republican Party, that he successfully forced the party to bend to his will, to his vision. But what if it was really the opposite, that the Republican Party invited Trump in and actually created the moment where he glided down that gold-plated escalator to Neil Young's Rockin' in the Free World, declaring his candidacy? Well, they didn't invite him in literally, of course, but, you know, he did that. But the conditions that allowed Trump to take over the party were there for years. And whether they like it or not, Republicans are now all wearing the red baseball cap. That's the argument in Tim Alberta's new book, American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. Tim is chief political correspondent for Politico magazine, and he has been watching the shift in the GOP for years now. Tim Alberta, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the Mueller hearings. I mean, what you see today is a full-throated defense on the part of the Republicans on these committees of President Trump. I mean, there's not one shred of criticism happening. So this pretty much sums up your thesis, right, that the Republican Party is in lockstep with President Trump. And looks like they will be for at least the next year or two.
Sure. Well, because it's important to recognize that in today's Republican Party, the fault line running through it is no longer over policy. It's no longer over ideology. It's no longer over, you know, specific legislative tactics. Those were the fault lines in the post-George W. Bush Republican Party when you saw this battle raging between, you know, the Tea Party and the establishment. Today, it's a pretty binary choice. Are you with Trump or are you against Trump? And to be against Trump is to put your career on the line, as we've seen with people like Jeff Flake and Mark Sanford, Justin Amash, who recently left the Republican Party after, you know, becoming the first Republican to advocate for impeachment proceedings. And he realized he would not be able to survive a Republican primary after taking that stance. So for any of these congressional Republicans who are in these hearings today, they understand full well that anything they do or say that could even be perceived as disloyal to the president is a real risk to their political careers. And on the other hand, they also realize that the president is watching, that he is very, very much attuned to who is defending him, who is really going to the mattresses with Mueller and with the Democrats, who is willing to fight and claw and scrap and kick and bite their way through a hearing like this to demonstrate their unflinching loyalty and fidelity to the president. And for a lot of these Republicans on these committees, they want to put on a show. They understand that there is one very special audience member out there watching them, and they want to do whatever they can to get in his good graces, to stay in his good graces, because that is the surest path to power in today's Republican Party.
It's really extraordinary, though, because just 3 years ago, right, it was pretty much the opposite. Most Republicans were appalled by him, and some weren't afraid to say it. They weren't afraid to say it many times. Paul Ryan, one of them, who, as we know, is no longer House Speaker, or in Congress for that matter. But in just 3 years, they have completely changed and decided that this is the guy that they want to follow to the end.
It's important to recognize something very fundamental about politicians, and this goes for politicians of all political stripe. They are reactionaries. They are not leaders, most of them. When you try to think about Trump's takeover of the party and how they all have fallen in line now behind him, you have to think about not Trump, but about the voters who support Trump. Most of these Republican elected officials had this light bulb moment, some point in late 2015, early 2016, where they realized, oh my gosh, my voters like this guy more than they like me. So the issue is not just their unwillingness to cross President Trump, but their unwillingness to cross his voters, to betray his base of supporters. So smelling out that inherent weakness in the party and its aversion to conflict was just as important as putting a finger on the pulse of a lot of those Americans who were disaffected and really disappointed and feeling betrayed by the political class.
Right. And so when people are feeling bad and scared and fearful of the future, they want a strong man. I mean, that's not just the case here.
No
it's
question.
The case everywhere. But
no question.
Your book is really interesting in that it takes you back into really into the back rooms, if you will, literally the back rooms, where this kind of begins, and it doesn't begin with Trump, and it doesn't begin necessarily in the last campaign. It begins far before that. And I want you to just take me back about a decade or so when you describe a key moment early in the Obama administration. The Democrats could have sealed their power for a generation. And this was during the stimulus meeting in 2009 when they're talking about the American Recovery Act, just after Obama is inaugurated. And there's a key moment there with key negotiators from both parties. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, well, as quick backdrop, you know, Obama comes in and the economy is still sort of in free-for-all. The bank bailouts helped to stabilize the global economic system, but millions of jobs are being shed and people are really panicking. Unemployment is up into the teens. And folks across the country, you know, Republicans and Democrats, no matter how they voted in 2008, they are looking to Washington for some sort of leadership. And it was really interesting because Obama's own inclination in that scenario was to bring a lot of Republicans into the room, get some of their ideas, reach something of a compromise, and make sure that everybody had skin in the game. Obama was basically convinced by Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and some other congressional Democrats, look, don't play footsies with these Republicans. Don't waste your time. Most of them aren't going to come aboard anyway. We don't need them. We have the numbers. Let's just pass our bill and pass it as fast as we can. And in fact, during this one meeting, Eric Cantor was trying to press his agenda, some of the things he wanted to see in the stimulus package. And Barack Obama says to him, look, Eric, elections have consequences and I won. And it was a moment that I think some of Obama's people in retrospect, they regret it, but they also downplay it and say, look, it wasn't meant to be hostile. He was just stating the facts. And by the way, he's right. Elections do have consequences, and Democrats had every right to take the lead in writing that bill. But what it sort of unintentionally did was antagonize Cantor and also antagonize a lot of Republicans who had been led to believe up until that point that Obama really was interested in a very bipartisan bill, a bill that was going to be a compromise between some of these Democratic priorities that they wanted, some of the Republican priorities. And really, that would have been in Obama's best interest politically, because you want the economic recovery to have everybody's fingerprints on it. You don't just want it to be the Democratic Party's recovery. And ultimately, that's what it wound up being. And what that allowed Republicans to do for the next 7 years was say, this is Obama's economic recovery that's failing. And if there had been a few dozen even of those House Republicans who had signed up, then it would have been a bipartisan bill and everything would have looked very differently.
Okay, so then they said, okay, we're not going to work with him from now on just because of that, and so be it?
No, I don't think it's quite that simple, but I do think that, you know, if you were a subscriber to the Mitch McConnell school of political gamesmanship, McConnell was one of those sort of obstructionists from the beginning who said to people, look, our path back to power is shattering this mystique of Obama's post-partisan image that he has projected out to the country, that he is not a rabid partisan, that he's going to come to Congress and he is going to work in a bipartisan manner and sort of restore sanity to the federal government and to the relationship between the White House and Capitol Hill, which had obviously been really strained during the Bush presidency. So a lot of Republicans subscribed to that, but there were plenty that didn't, and plenty of people who were, again, sort of taking a wait-and-see approach, believing that Obama would work with them. And to the extent that that episode proved anything, it was that it proved to some of those Republicans who were giving Obama the benefit of the doubt that he was, in fact, much more partisan than they wanted to believe, and that the well had sort of been poisoned, and that he had proven that he was, just as George W. Bush had been, and just as Bill Clinton in some cases had been, that he was going to just sort of use his superior numbers just to run roughshod over the minority party. And frankly, that was something that Pelosi and Reid, that they were pretty unapologetic about at the time. They felt like George W. Bush and his Republicans, when they had majorities, they had done nothing to encourage bipartisanship, which was true. And so they felt like when they took over Washington in January of 2009, that they didn't need to just wait around for Republicans and try and get them on board.
And then comes the Tea Party and then the beheading of the Republican Party, in a sense, aside from Mitch McConnell, right?
Yeah. So. And the Tea Party arises in response both to Barack Obama, clearly, but also in response to a Republican establishment that they believed, to Trump's point, was just weak and that was unwilling to fight, that was, you know, it was this country club, Chamber of Commerce, Republican Party that was just very comfortable and that was very elite in its approach.
Yeah, so Eric Cantor loses his job. John Boehner, he's gone. You have an interesting moment because fast forward to now, and you have sort of a similar movement in the Democratic Party on the left, and you have a moment where Joe Crowley, who was unseated by AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, he was in line to lead the House eventually. He meets with Eric Cantor, also in line to lead the House eventually, both out. And they basically are like, hey, what happened, buddy?
What on earth has happened to our political system? And I think that some of these similarities between the Tea Party class of 10 and some of these new progressive members who came in 18, I think they're overblown because, for one thing, you had scores of these Tea Party conservatives that came in 2010, and really you only do have four of these very outspoken progressive firebrands who came in 2018. So I think it's speaking for a much smaller percentage of the party, certainly today, but that having been said, what AOC and what the squad have been able to tap into and what they've been able to expose on the left is, I think, very similar to what Trump exposed on the right, which is the systemic weakening of the party institutions themselves. So we think a lot of, in American life, about the weakening of institutions, whether it's the media or organized religion or public education, you name it, and the lack of confidence, the declining faith in those institutions. But we don't often think about political parties as institutions, and they definitely are. And the Republican Party as an institution was weakened over a period of 10 to 15 years before Donald Trump came along. And he exploited that in a way that was just, you know, really, really breathtaking to behold. And I think what AOC is beginning to expose, and some of her comrades, they are exposing the sort of complacency and atrophy in the Democratic Party's establishment. This is a party that is led by septuagenarians on Capitol Hill, a party whose current frontrunner for the nomination is a septuagenarian who tells all of these anecdotes in his stump speech about the 1970s, and people's eyes just sort of gloss over, like, what are we talking about here? And I think that to the extent that there is a changing of the guard and sort of a progressive revolution taking hold in the Democratic Party, it's going to be really interesting to see whether some of those establishment figures, like Nancy Pelosi, like Joe Biden, whether they are effectively able to keep a lid on it and push back against it in ways that the Republican leaders never were.
That is interesting. And so how does this set up for 2020? Who, everyone's wondering, who is the best candidate to defeat Trump? Can Trump be defeated?
Well, he can certainly be defeated. It's worth recognizing that Donald Trump won the presidency in 2016 with one of the truly fluky victories in American political history. He lost the popular vote by nearly 3 million, and he won in the Electoral College on the strength of victories in three states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, that he carried by a combined 77,744 votes, right? So he's got a very thin margin for error that he is working with. Now, yes, Trump does have a strong level of support among Republicans, certainly among his core base of Republicans. But we know from watching the 2018 returns come in and contrasting them against the 2016 returns that Democrats took back the House last November on the strength of flipping these congressional districts from coast to coast in a lot of these suburban environments, from Atlanta to Detroit to New York to L.A., Salt Lake City, you name it, right? All across the country in these suburban media markets with a lot of these traditionally Republican voters who are affluent and college educated and fiscally conservative but sort of socially moderate. A lot of them who pulled the trigger for Trump in 16, a lot of them pulled the trigger for a Democrat in 2018. And the question, I think, is if these are the new swing voters, these suburbanite moderates, how are they responding not only to Trump and to his rhetoric about immigration and the squad and any number of these other things, but also how are they responding to a Democratic Party that is now moving decidedly left itself? When they hear about all of these candidates offering to cover the entire undocumented immigrant population with their health care plans. And that was something that Barack Obama was adamant 10 years ago that he would never do, that he did not think that that was appropriate to do. When you talk about Medicare for All and potentially throwing 150 million people off of their private insurance programs, these are policy stances taken by many of these Democrats now in order to win a primary. But how much damage does it do to them come general election time? And that was, of course, the question for Mitt Romney in 2012 and John McCain in 2008. These guys had to veer so far right to win their party's nomination that it really crippled them come general election time. So obviously, Donald Trump wants to paint the entire Democratic Party with this broad brush of socialism and wild-eyed liberalism. And there is a real fear among Democrats I know that they are going to play right into his hands, that this primary process is going to incentivize and accelerate this rush to the left that ultimately could be very beneficial to Donald Trump in holding on to a lot of those independent voters come November.
However, the lesson from your book is do not ignore that side of the party, the populist side of the party. You do that at your peril, and then you get Donald Trump.
That's absolutely right. There is a temptation to view Trump and Trumpism as a cautionary tale, and all of the, you know, havoc he hath wrought and the damage it's going to do the Republican Party in the long term. But look, in the short term, Republicans got two Supreme Court justices. They got a big tax cut. They got tons of deregulation. They got all manner of social policy executed through executive orders on abortion, on religious liberty, on contraceptive mandates, you name it. So I think, look, Democrats may just look at the Trump model as a blueprint and say, hey, maybe if we do just push farther and farther to the left, that when we actually win, then we're going to have a mandate to do a lot of these very progressive things that may be considered out of the mainstream. But just like Trump did, Trump has basically ignored the middle of the electorate and delivered for his base. And I think that that is something that's very unusual in politics. Typically, politicians, especially presidents, they try to appeal to the many at the expense of the few. And Trump has essentially done the exact opposite. And while it may wind up costing him and the party in the short term and maybe in the long term, obviously, it has paid some dividends already. And a lot of Republicans feel like Trump has delivered the goods in a way that most Republican politicians, a President Jeb Bush or a President Marco Rubio, never would have been able to do.
Right. So that's a lesson for Joe Biden right there. Correct?
And, yeah, potentially.
And people who think that he could take on, he's the best person to take on Trump.
Yeah, or Joe, you know, or even for a Kamala Harris or an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders, people who are viewed potentially as unelectable because maybe they're too liberal. I think that is the argument that some of their supporters are going to make.
Okay. Meanwhile, at the very end of your book, you have Paul Ryan wringing his hands and saying, "Where's this party going? This is not my party. Is it ever going to be his party again?"
Probably. Nothing's permanent in politics, and Karl Rove is fond of saying that, and I agree with him. I think you see these long cycles and these durable trends take root in parties that can sometimes take 10 or 20 or 25 years for things to come back around full circle. But look, what Ryan was saying to me in our interview for the book is true, that the Barry Goldwater, John Birch Society Republican Party was kind of crushed under the heel of William F. Buckley and the neoconservative movement and Reaganism. And Donald Trump has now in many ways displaced Reaganism as the blueprint for what a Republican Party should be, how to mobilize its base. So that will last for a finite period of time. And whether that's, you know, 6 more years or 25 more years, we don't really know yet. But what we do know is that political parties exist to protect and perpetuate their own power. And as soon as the Republican Party takes a couple of beatings at the ballot box, which they inevitably will do, and we don't know when it's going to happen, but we know that it's going to happen because that's just the natural rhythm of electoral politics. Once Republicans take those beatings at the ballot box, they will begin to recalibrate. They will begin to modulate their positions. They will begin to distance themselves from the Trump Republican Party. And that's going to take a while, and it's not going to be easy, because I think many Republicans are beginning to recognize that this is not just on matters of policy, but on matters of behavior and on matters of rhetoric and on matters of how we treat our fellow Americans. A lot of damage has been done during this period of time, and they will have a lot of pieces to pick up.
Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico magazine, and his latest book is called American Carnage: On the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
And Steve Chiotakis is here now with a preview of Greater LA coming up in about 15 minutes from now. Hi.
A lot of folks look at the political climate today and they maybe want to smoke a little weed.
Or a lot of weed.
A lot of weed. There's a lot of weed growing up the Central Coast. One farmer family went from avocados to pot to try to save the family farm.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because pot is more expensive?
Well, it's more expensive, and obviously. And they're looking to the future.
But is it tastier than an avocado?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you could mix the two, I guess.
I guess they're both green. All right.
Maybe you'll do a segment.
Maybe. Thank you, Steve. That's Greater LA coming up at 1. Coming up, how farming in California is changing because of climate change.
Look, this is the way it is. I know it sounds crazy, but big chunks of California are getting super hot in the way that the Middle East is hot. And don't forget, the Middle East is also the center of domesticated agriculture.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Agriculture, obviously big business here in California. The entire industry, though, faces a reckoning, what with a threat of climate change, and nowhere is that truer than in the Central Valley. Just outside Modesto, farmers and researchers are working on ways to keep feeding us through the next few decades, and hopefully longer. They're trying to develop new farming techniques to help the region better transition to the hotter, drier, and saltier climate on the horizon. Joining me now is Mark Shapiro, an environmental journalist and lecturer at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. Hi.
Hi.
Well, the central question here is, what can we plant now that won't just shrivel up and die when temperatures get hotter?
Well, excellent question. And that's what drove me down to the Central Valley as a way to kind of understand both what's happening in California, but this tells us a lot about what's happening essentially around the world with the climatic shifts and everything. And so in the Central Valley, like you said, you know, we've got increasing heat, we've got decreasing water, we've got increasing salt in the soil. So the question is, how does big ag adapt to this situation? What I found was a number of different things. Number one, new crops emerging. Crops that emanate originally in places like the Middle East and Iran, Central Asia, are now making their way into California, most notably pistachios.
Well, let's talk about pistachios because we know that almonds are big business here in California. They demand a lot of water. Why are pistachios any different?
Pistachios demand at least 30% less water. And the other important thing about a pistachio is that it doesn't die when there's not enough water. What happens with an almond tree, and I've seen this, and you can see this now in the valley and elsewhere, is that when there's not enough water, an almond tree will actually die. It'll crumble up and die for lack of water. A pistachio tree has the capacity to essentially sustain itself even in times of extreme water stress and then come back. And pistachios also have a much longer lifespan, apparently. They grow for like up to 80 years, which is kind of incredible since the average almond tree is more like 20 to 25 years.
Hmm. So are all these farmers now plowing under their almond trees and putting in pistachio trees instead?
I wouldn't say all, because actually people are still growing almond trees. if you drive up Highway 5, you'll still see a lot of almond trees. But increasingly, actually, what's happening is that some of those almond orchards are being replaced with pistachio orchards or other trees, even fig trees, kiwi trees, and these kind of fruits that are adapted to a hot, dry climate.
I'm just waiting for pistachio milk. Is that on the horizon?
I'm sure it is.
Okay. So in general, we are going to end up looking more like the Middle East, heat-wise and fruit. And nut-wise.
Yeah. And I think, look, this is the way it is. I know it sounds crazy, but big chunks of California are getting super hot in the way that the Middle East is hot. And don't forget, the Middle East is also the center of domesticated agriculture. So you've had agriculture there growing for, you know, for thousands of years. You've had seeds and plants and trees that have evolved to those conditions.
Yeah. Well, so there is a big difference, at least geographically, between the two areas, and that is the presence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers.
Yes.
We don't have that. We have fake rivers.
Yes. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. The California Aqueduct.
Yes.
For example.
We tried to invent our own Tigris and Euphrates River. Yeah.
Is it sufficient, our system?
It's not. And when we start having trouble with our invented Tigris and Euphrates, we are actually seeing a lot of trouble. And that's some of the major stresses that are now being experienced in the Central Valley. You still have to have water. And there are two things happening on the waterfront, and it's just like two fundamental parts of the California sort of agriculture system. One is that the whole system was designed to have snowfall in the wintertime, sit there in the top of the Sierra Mountains until like around March or April. Now the problem is that the water is not falling as snow anymore because it's too hot in the atmosphere, so most often it's not snow that's falling, but it's rain, which means the rain falls down, comes to the Sierras, and rolls right off the Sierra straight into the Pacific at a time when they don't need water imports in the Central Valley. And so that's been a huge hit on water supplies there. At the same time, in the past, farmers could actually go down. When they didn't get enough water coming from the mountains, they could actually go down and dig wells into the aquifer. Well, you've had thousands of wells sucking from that aquifer now for several decades, and it's seriously depleted. And so the state of California is starting to put regulations on how much water each individual farm can get from those aqueducts, which is pretty much freaking out farmers all across the valley. I talked to a lot of farmers down there. This is hanging there like a sword of Damocles.
And they haven't come up with a solution.
Well, there's not like one solution. I will tell you a couple things that are interesting about it. Number one is this has highlighted the vulnerability of this industrial agriculture system when you have a very narrow set of seeds that are bred for a very specific set of conditions. And those conditions are no longer happening. So what's another response is actually a different way of growing food. So not only is it the crops themselves, but actually agricultural practices. And it's over and over again, I saw this all over the valley. People who have been growing crops on more organically rich soils, on soils that use cover crops that actually return minerals back into the plants and actually create a cycle between the plants and the soil. And that organically rich soil is also much better at absorbing water and are far more resilient to change in conditions of high environmental stress.
So looking forward a couple decades, who's going to be growing the crops that we now grow in California, where it's going to be too hot to grow these crops? Where are they going to go?
Who's going to grow? You mean who's going to keep growing food?
Well, I mean, we are.
How about the world? You can ask that question about the world.
Yeah, yes, I guess.
But here we are. So basically, there's an amazing nursery down in the Central Valley outside of Modesto called the Duarte Nursery, which is like a family-run nursery. It's now huge. And they've been researching intensively how to develop tree crops and other crops that are resistant to high salt quantities, low amounts of water. And, you know, and I went into their lab. I mean, they have this amazing lab where they basically have like thousands of samples of little treelets in tiny little translucent tubes that are growing in simulated conditions, which they're anticipating, not both the conditions now, which are dry and salty, and conditions they anticipate in 5-10 years down the line, and trying to come up with tree varieties and such that are adapted to those conditions. We're not talking GMOs here. I want to clarify. This is more old-fashioned breeding with very sophisticated techniques. And so I would say there's some hope in that kind of approach. Also, I think there's a great amount of hope in the smaller farms where you can actually see the more diverse crops actually being grown And you see over and over and over again how those diverse farms, which are now actually relatively small, turn out to be far more resilient to change than the kind of industrial chemical dependent seeds and agriculture. And that's actually been very interesting. In a way, climate change has shining a huge light on the vulnerabilities of the industrial agriculture system and really showing us the potential of this kind of more ecologically harmonious form of growing food.
Mark Shapiro, he teaches at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and he's author of the book Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, Michelle, it was seven-ish hours of Mueller
today. I feel, on the one hand, like I ran a marathon.
On the other
but
hand,
on the other,
you were sitting in front of your computer.
Right. And also didn't accomplish much in running that marathon, that it was a fruitless marathon.
Right. You didn't reach a finish line.
Yeah. There wasn't a collusion.
No one got a trophy.
Conclusion. God. Oh, my God. I just said collusion instead of conclusion. That tells you everything that you need to know. We got a little feedback. We've got Kate Gardner in response to the Mueller hearing says, get that man a drink. Could not agree more. It's Max Fresco says, I caught a portion of the. Okay. Rewind.
Yeah, it's too much.
There's too much. You can't process it all. No. I mean, you watch six and a half hours of that stuff.
Well, it comes down to we all are where we were at the beginning.
Exactly. Nothing has changed. Everything has changed.
And yet nothing has changed. And maybe you'll go run another marathon.
Maybe.
Maybe you'll start training for another
maybe
one.
Maybe I'll read that 500-page Mueller report. Finally. But yeah, we had great coverage.
That was the laugh of a madwoman.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
You're exhausted. We're all exhausted.
Pizza time.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle Aloy. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.